Welcome to Spirit of the Camino, a podcast about the unique and magical experience that is the Camino de Santiago. Join us on this adventure and discover the spirit of the Camino for yourself.
Hello, and welcome back to the Spirit of the Camino podcast. I'm Nick, I'm here with Wendy, and we are back in our home in Lisbon. We just returned yesterday from our latest Camino, which, as we talked about last time, was the Camino do Mar from Lisbon to Fatima.
Yep, so we made it to Fatima. We passed our initiation ritual as newly minted Portuguese citizens. And I think we did learn more about the Portuguese spirit. We'll talk about that probably in the next episode. But it was quite an adventure. It had its ups and downs. Some parts I really loved, some parts not so much. So yeah, let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, that's a Camino in a nutshell, right? It's not always rainbows and unicorns every day. So as you mentioned, we'll talk a little bit more in the next episode about certain things. So what we decided to do was, in this episode, we're going to talk about the Camino itself, which is our 10-day walk from Lisbon to Fatima. And in the next episode, we will talk about the destination, Fatima, and look at it in terms of how it compares to Santiago de Compostela, for example, and just what we learned and what we observed from being in Fatima, and also during a very special time to be in Fatima. But we'll get to that in the next episode. So as you said, ups and downs. And so we're going to look at this Camino in four ways today, looking at highlights, lowlights, some practicalities, and then finishing with a couple of discussion points as we like to do. So we'll start with highlights. What are some of the things that you really liked on this Camino?
Well, we talked in the previous episode about some of the places that you pass along the way and, you know, potentially stay in, depending on how you want to organize your stages, most of which we have already been to before. So we knew that they were really nice places, and in some cases, you know, we're really looking forward to going back to them. So of those, I'd say the one that I really enjoyed the most was Alcobaça. Just because we'd only been there once before, and it was quite a long time ago. It was before we'd even moved to Portugal. We were just here on a brief visit. That was actually the trip when we decided that we would move to Portugal. But anyway, I recalled it more or less, but I didn't have a really clear image in my mind of what the monastery in Alcobaça looked like. So I really enjoyed going back there. It was pretty empty when we were there. I'm not sure why, if it was just the time of day, because we went pretty late in the afternoon, but we had it almost to ourselves, and it was a really peaceful, quiet place of, you know, reflection, contemplation, and really beautiful.
Yeah, I think we were a little bit lucky in the way that the Camino unfolded, that Alcobaça was on the eighth day. And by then we were really into the rhythm of the Camino, firstly. And secondly, we had done a short day to walk into Alcobaça. So we had the time and the energy to explore the monastery at the end of the day. Whereas if we look back to the first few days of the Camino, we were walking longer stages and we did not have energy really at the end of the day to do much tourism.
No, the first few days of this Camino just about killed me. I mean, we were both, I think, really exhausted at the end of every day. And yeah, we did pass through some interesting towns. Cascais was where we stayed the first night. Sintra was where we stayed the second night. Those are both really interesting towns with lots to see. Sintra in particular has all kinds of palaces and things to see. Luckily, we have been there multiple times before, so we haven't seen everything, but we have seen a lot of it, which was good because we had absolutely no energy. We didn't even go out to dinner in Sintra. We ordered food and had it delivered from Uber Eats to our guest house.
we might get into that a bit more, but that was a particularly epic day and we were really, really wrecked at the end of it. But, you know, going back to some of the sites or the particular places, you mentioned Alcobaça, which is, you know, near the end of this Camino, so a little bit far from Lisbon comparatively, but a lot of the other places that are interesting to visit, some of them you've just mentioned, Cascais, Sintra, also Mafra and Óbidos, they're all pretty close to Lisbon. They're all really within an hour of Lisbon by public transport. So there's probably a couple of ways that you can think about it, that, you know, if you come to Lisbon for a vacation or for a holiday, you could visit all of these places just either by renting a car or by using public transportation. And so you might think, well, why should we then do a Camino that goes to all these places, you know, again? But on the other hand, you could say, well, instead of doing 4 or 5 half day or full day trips to these places, you could walk this Camino and then knock all these places out, you know, as part of your Camino. So there's a couple of different ways you can think about it. But if you have never been to Lisbon before, then this can be a great way to discover some of these places that are near Lisbon that are also very interesting. Because if you look, and we'll come back to this later, if you look at the standard Portuguese way from Lisbon, it doesn't really have highlights early on close to Lisbon. So yeah, the Camino do Mar is very different because you walk to the west out of Lisbon. And again, as we talked about last time, the official starting point is Estoril. That's about one day's walk from Lisbon, but we started at our home in Lisbon. And you don't really go, you're walking along the river the whole time and you're not really going through any kind of industrial areas. You're more into almost holiday areas quite quickly.
Yeah.
A place like Estoril, for example, is a place that's on the beach, and there's lots of holiday makers when we were walking there. So we spent the first night in Cascais, which is a well-known beach town in the sort of far western part of this part of Portugal. And then the second day was really interesting, the day we just mentioned before that we were absolutely exhausted by, because you start in Cascais. And it's interesting because we had actually walked most of this stage twice before as part of day hikes or training hikes. But in those cases, we started in Sintra and we walked downhill to the coast. Mm-hmm. And so the first difference was that this was uphill and not downhill. And the second difference was that there's an extra 10 kilometers walking from Cascais to the coast at the point where you turn inland. So it was a harder day and a longer day
than what we had done it as before. Yeah. I feel like the going uphill, I mean, I'm kind of weird in that I enjoy hill walking a lot more than flat walking. So I think it was more the flat, the extra 10 kilometers flat on the coast that really did me in more so than walking up the hills. I was kind of surprised that I didn't feel like we had walked that we had climbed that much and increased the elevation that much. Whereas I always thought of Sintra as being this town up in the hills. It's always much cooler, or typically anyway, much cooler up there than it is in Lisbon. So I had this idea that it was at a much higher elevation. But then when we walked it, I thought, well, it must not actually be that much higher because I don't feel like we've climbed that much. But nevertheless, yeah, the day as a whole really took a lot out of me.
Right. So the first 10 kilometers of that day, you're walking essentially along the coast. And it is really beautiful coast in that area. You know, we've talked about this several times before about different stretches of coastline in Portugal, and we've obviously mentioned that if you walk the Rota Vicentina, which is south of Lisbon in the regions that are the Alentejo and the Algarve, the coast is incredible. You've got all these cliffs and all this amazing rugged coastline. And then if you walk, for example, the Portuguese coastal from Porto in the north of the country, it's not like that at all. It's very flat, it's quite rocky, and for me, not nearly as interesting. And I would say this stretch of coastline here was much more similar to the southern Portuguese coast. Not quite as spectacular as what you see on the Rota Vicentina, but you've got these cliffs, you have these big waves, and you have these kind of coves, and it was really quite interesting. And you go all the way to a beach which is very well known. It's called the Praia do Guincho, and that's one of the most famous, or if not the most famous, beach in that area, or in the sort of greater Lisbon area. Until you get further north to places like Nazaré. And so the first 10 kilometers of that day were really nice, walking along the coast and having these great views. And then, but that's it in terms of the mar, or the sea or ocean part of this Camino do Mar. And then you turn inland, you walk on boardwalks for a very short period of time, about 10 minutes. And then now you're in forest, basically climbing up to Sintra. So that day was, we described it as really epic because we did about 28 kilometers, I think. And almost all of it was on pavement, which is difficult, but the scenery was really amazing, both the coastal scenery, then coming into forest, then coming out into Sintra. And it's interesting that Sintra is a very foggy town. I call it the foggiest town in Portugal. I don't know if that's scientifically proven, but that's what I call it, because sometimes you can have a day here in Lisbon where you don't have a cloud in the sky, and then you can take the train or otherwise get to Sintra, and it's completely foggy, and you can almost you have no visibility at all. Mm-hmm. And then you'll come back to Lisbon at the end of the day, and it's a beautiful day in Lisbon again. And so it really has a microclimate there. And as we were walking up, it was kind of unusual, actually. We took a break. There's a welcome center or an interpretation center for this kind of land area as you're going up. And we've been there before. And we took a break just to use the bathroom and get fill up on water and just have a little rest. And while we were doing that, it just started pouring with rain.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of came out of nowhere. Like, it had been a really nice morning. And yeah, maybe it was clouding over a little bit, but we hadn't understood that it was about to rain. And so we were kind of lucky in a way that we were inside for this downpour. And then it sort of eased off a little bit. And then we started walking. It was still raining a little bit, but not too much. And we started walking in the rain for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. And then it stopped. But then by the time we got to Sintra, there again wasn't a cloud in the sky. And it was quite amazing and unusual, because having seen this rain and having seen these clouds come over, we thought, okay, in Sintra, it's going to be, as Sintra always is, it's going to be foggy, it's going to be cloudy, we're not going to be able to see anything. But it was the complete opposite of that. But it was great to walk into Sintra, being sunny, having blue skies. And one of the things about Sintra that people who have been there will know is that some of the sites, the Penna Palace and the Moorish Castle, are way up on hills above the town. And so that's one of the things that's a bit of a shame about often the lack of visibility in Sintra, is that you can't see these places from the town. But we were able, as we were walking in, to have perfect views of those two castles, the one castle and the one palace, as well as some of the other palaces as we walked past them. And actually the route that takes you into Sintra takes you past the two other palaces, the two other main palaces of Sintra, which are the Quinta da Regaleira and the National Palace. So basically there are four main sites in Sintra, and we got to see all of them as we walked through, some at a distance and some closer up. And as you mentioned, we didn't go into any of them because we've been to them before, and because we were absolutely wrecked, and it was probably 5, 6 p.m. by this point.
Yeah,
as well.
I think they were closed by that point anyway.
Because we sort of, it took us a few days to get into the rhythm of the Camino. And so the first 3 days we were walking, you know, upper 20s in kilometers, which are long days, but not, you know, incredibly long days. But it seemed like it just took us all day, and we just didn't have the same speed that we might usually have.
Yeah, we were arriving very, very late, like, yeah, 6 p.m., several days in a row. And yeah, I didn't really understand why exactly. I guess we were just being slow. I mean, we were both having foot problems. It's normal for me to have foot pain when walking, but you were wearing some new shoes, and that was causing some pain for you too. So I guess that was really slowing us down, and we were taking longer breaks. And when it all added up, we were arriving really late and really tired. So fortunately, I mean, if we had stuck to the typical stages that people tend, or that are suggested and that people seem to tend to walk, we probably would have continued to arrive at 6 p.m. pretty much every day. But you had done a lot of planning beforehand and found ways where we could shorten those stages and stay in, you know, not in a town, but in some cases on a little farm and a little countryside guest house, kind of in the middle of nowhere, but in a place where we would be able to break up a stage into two stages, for example. So then we started having shorter days, and that made it more bearable.
Yeah, and we'll come back to more specific details on the stages in a minute. But so of the places that are the real highlight places, Alcobaça, we've talked about, Sintra, obviously. And the other one, I think, if we're looking at a big three, is Óbidos, which is a really lovely medieval town. And again, we've been there several times before. And that was, you know, it's always great to go there. And it was interesting that we stayed the night in Óbidos. And we know from past experience that if you want to go there, if sometimes, for example, if we have friends or relatives who come and we want to go there with them, we always want to go early to get there before the big crowds of people come. And in this case, we were there late in the day, which is kind of a similar idea. You're not there in the middle of the day. But you were following a blog that was written by a Brazilian pilgrim who had done the Caminho do Mar a couple of years ago. And he had mentioned, basically, according to the stages that he did, by the time he arrived in Óbidos, it was in the middle of the day, and it was just so packed that he basically didn't even really go into the old town because there were just too many people. Was that right?
Yeah. I mean, he kept referring to it as the castle, but I think he was kind of seeing the whole town as a castle, because it is a completely walled town. All of the the surrounding, you know, town walls are still intact, so it can kind of look like the whole town itself is a castle. So I wasn't sure exactly what he was referring to when he was saying castle, because there is actually a castle as well inside the town. But yeah, he basically said that he gave up on attempting to visit the castle because he just couldn't make his way through the streets because they were so absolutely packed with people, and that there were 10, you know, tourist buses, big bus loads of tourists, and, you know, he saw the buses sitting there in the parking lot when he arrived, so he knew it was going to be busy. But yeah, apparently it was just too busy to even make your way through the streets, which sounds horrible. I don't know how much of that was just, you know, the fact that he had been on Camino for a few days, so he was used to being by himself and in quiet nature, and it was just a shock to the system, or if literally he couldn't move. But yeah, it sounded pretty bad.
Yeah, but don't let that put you off, Obidush. Our recommendation would be, if you're going to walk this Camino, to stay there the night, and then you get to spend the evening, or maybe the late afternoon and evening there, and even maybe spend some time the next morning there before you continue on your Camino. And in that way, you can really experience it when there are much fewer people there, and it's really a magical place when it's not really crowded.
Yeah, definitely. And there's not a lot of information out there about this Camino, but of the various proposed stages that I saw, I don't think I saw any that included an overnight stay in Obidush. People seem to stay in Caldas de Rainha, which is a few kilometers further on, which is also a sizable town and has plenty of amenities and things. And it's an interesting enough town to stay in, but given the choice of Obidush and Caldas de Rainha, I would definitely choose Obidush.
Yeah, completely agree. And I just also wanted to touch on a couple of the other natural or scenic aspects of this Camino. We talked about the ocean and then coming up into the hills of Sintra, but there were a few other things. On our fourth day, and this was going from Mafra to Torres Vedras, we walked through vineyards for a huge portion of the day. And, you know, not just a situation where you're walking alongside vineyards, which we did, but also one of those, it was just one of those types of days where you can walk in some hills or in certain situations where you're above the vineyards or where you have a view and you're really looking out over all these vineyards. And that's amazing because that's when, or for me, that's when vineyards are most interesting, when you're kind of seeing the patterns of them and you can sort of see a few different hills and the way that they're patterned differently. And it reminded us a little bit of when we've walked in the Douro Valley in the north of Portugal. And that's Portugal's most famous wine growing region. So it wasn't quite at that level, but you made the point that you thought it was the next best vineyard viewing that we had seen on Camino.
Yeah, I did say that, and I will stand by it. I thought it was gorgeous, and it was quite a surprise. I mean, I, like you mentioned, I had been reading this blog written by this Brazilian pilgrim. His name is Osvaldo Butso. Yeah, so he had mentioned that there were vineyards. I was aware of that, but I just didn't think it would be so spectacular. And yeah, it was definitely some of the best scenery that we had seen up to that point and throughout most of the Camino, really.
And we did see some vineyards, some isolated vineyards, you know, as we continued for the next several days after that, but not to the extent that we saw on that day. But that was a real highlight as well. And then the other thing regarding nature, which was a bit of a surprise, really, because we sort of felt in the middle days that the Camino lost its way a little bit for a couple of reasons, but just in terms of the landscape, it became a bit samey and it became a little bit boring. And I guess that tends to happen, but we were kind of going through some farmland, but there wasn't much natural beauty. Mm-hmm. It was rural areas, but not necessarily really beautiful rural areas. And that's sort of on our days 5 to 8. So let's say between Torres Vedras and Alcobaça. And then from Alcobaça onwards, which was the last 2 days for us, and especially the last day, suddenly we started walking through these mountain ranges, which are Portuguese mountains, so they're not the Alps, but they were still mountains, more or less. And the scenery there was quite spectacular, and that was unexpected for me, at least.
Yeah. I had been reading and, reading this blog primarily. That was the only kind of firsthand information I found other than just, changes in elevation and statistics and things like that. So yeah, I had read this description, but still it exceeded my expectations in terms of how beautiful it was and how really wild and rugged it was, which was very different from the farmlands that we had been walking through the previous days, as you mentioned.
Yeah, so I would say apart from some of those middle days, which we didn't enjoy that much, the rest of it was really enjoyable overall, both in terms of the variety of landscape going from ocean to hills and vineyards and mountains, and also some of these sites that we've been mentioning, which are varied and different on their own. We also, a couple of little highlights were things that were unexpected or things that we weren't aware of before we started. In particular, there was a museum, an archaeological museum, which we'd never heard of, mm-hmm. and it's a rural museum. But it was very, very good.
Yeah, it was. And I just happened to see it on the map. Actually, Osvaldo didn't mention it in this case, so I guess he didn't stop there. But yeah, I just saw on maps.me, which is where we were using, that's where we had uploaded the tracks to follow along the Camino, which is great for tracks. It's not great for showing landmarks. It's pretty poor at that, actually. So this was one of the few kind of landmark things that was marked in maps.me. So it kind of caught my eye that there were supposedly some Roman archaeological ruins in this town. And then I looked it up and thought, hey, yeah, I think this would be worth stopping and checking out while we pass through. And yeah, the museum was incredibly well done. We were given a private tour for free. They never charged us anything. They didn't even charge an entrance fee. And everything was really well laid out. They had actually built a new museum, which was several decades ago now. But when it first opened, it was in kind of a makeshift area. And then they had a purpose-built building made just to house the particular pieces that they have to display. And so it was done really well. They had created, you know, these specific niches that were of just the right size and had good lighting and everything. So I think you really enjoyed photographing inside the museum.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to the way you display your artifacts. And as you said, it looked like they had recently built some of these rooms specifically to house what they had. And so they were just able to do it in a really good way. And we were just really surprised for, you know, when you think about a rural museum on a Camino, you know, it's often something where the dust is gathering and mm-hmm. hasn't really been touched for decades and things like that. And this was just completely the opposite of that. So it's in a place called Odrinhas, or really it's just outside this village called Odrinhas, but we'll put a link to it, or we'll write its name at least in the description so you can check it out. But that was a surprise, and it really took us through a lot of Portuguese history, from Roman history to Visigothic to Christian medieval after that, and in fact to Muslim between the Visigothic and the later medieval periods. And so it was a little journey through, you know, the ancient and medieval history of Portugal just in an hour or so. And so that was really good. And a few of the other things, we walked through or passed quite a few old windmills at various times, mm-hmm. Which is always nice.
Yeah, it was really cool to walk right next to the windmills, right alongside them. There were one or two that we could go inside because they were quite abandoned and dilapidated. And there were some others that were not in use, but did still have doors, you know, intact. And so those we couldn't go into. But it was fun to just walk along the hill and pass them as we went along.
All right, so those are some of the highlights of the Camino do Mar. As we mentioned, we did find, especially in the middle section, that there were some parts that we didn't love. But if we look at the lowlights of this Camino, I think it all really comes back to the same basic thing, which is that there was a lot of asphalt walking. Mm-hmm. And related to that was that we felt that the Camino was not designed the way we thought it should have been. And so what that means is that you are walking on road for a fair amount of the time. And then sometimes we would just see things that we thought were inexplicable to us, which is that you would see, for example, let's say we would have the tracks that we would be looking at on maps.me, as you mentioned, and you could see that there was a loop or a semicircle, which was on a road and was, you know, making a big turn. And then we could see on maps.me that there was a track, which is a dirt path, that went from that same point A to point B via a direct line rather than taking this convoluted loop. And so it basically was not only quicker, but also a dirt path that might have taken you past some trees or whatnot instead of being on the road. And we just saw things like that so often and just didn't understand why the arrows and subsequently the tracks didn't take these shorter, nicer routes rather than the longer routes along the road. And, you know, a lot of times on a Camino, you're faced with the choice sometimes of taking a nicer route that's longer or a less nice route that's quicker and more direct. But this time, there didn't seem to be any reason because the nicer route was also the quicker route.
Right. Yeah. So that was kind of inexplicable. I mean, we have our own theories about why that might be. Maybe we'll get into that more in the next episode. I'm not sure. But yeah, I did find it very surprising, and I was trying to avoid asphalt walking as much as possible because it really has a huge impact on how much pain I experience while walking. So there was one day where we created our own Camino pretty much and didn't follow the tracks for hardly any of that day, because looking at maps.me, I could see that there were little dotted lines showing that there were tracks that were both more direct and seemed like they would be unpaved. And that was the case. So we ended up walking through a lot of eucalyptus forest or eucalyptus plantations. And they were, you know, this was not a case of, oh, this might be like a tiny walking path that's going to be overgrown because not many people use it. No, these were huge logging roads. I mean, they were dirt roads, but they were big enough for cars and trucks to go down. So they very easily could have become part of the Camino, but for whatever reason, the people who laid out the path decided to take the road instead, which, yeah, I found puzzling. So we, yeah, created our own Camino that one day and ended up shaving off several kilometers and also having, I'm sure, a nicer experience overall. I think we did miss out on some more vineyards because it was the day after we saw the vineyards, and according to Osvaldo, to the Brazilian blog that I was reading, there were more vineyards on that day if you followed the traditional route. So we missed that, but we had already seen those, so we felt like that was a trade-off that we were willing to make. So we had a little adventure, you know, seeing if we could make it through and not come up against any gates that would stop us and make us have to turn around. And it actually worked out. It worked really well.
Yeah, I think in general, you know, we walked this as a Camino de Fatima with the mindset of walking a Camino de Santiago, because that's what we know. And to your point, we will talk about this a little bit more later on, but we felt that perhaps the reason why there was so much road walking on this Camino the way it was designed is that because, as we mentioned last time, that people who walk to Fatima as part of a pilgrimage to Fatima in a Portuguese group walk on the road. And that's part of the way that it's done. And so perhaps the idea to try to create paths off the road just wasn't front and center in the minds of the people when they were creating this track or this path to begin with. And it's interesting because last time I mentioned that, you know, we were talking about DIY Caminos, and I was saying, well, we tend not to do that because if you walk a proper marked path, then it's going to take you off the road as much as possible. It turned out that that perhaps wasn't true on this Camino. Mm-hmm. And so then, ironically, we did do a DIY this one day in particular and found less road doing it that way. But yeah, so that was unfortunate. And then, as we said, but on our days 5 to 8, that kind of the combination of walking a lot of asphalt with some farmland that wasn't really that visually interesting or appealing led us to just to a few days where we weren't really loving it. And then, but the last couple of days were really, really great, starting with the visit to the monastery in Alcobaça. And so then we got redemption, let's say, at the end, because really the first 4 days we really enjoyed despite the asphalt because there were so many things to see, some of the places we've mentioned already. And then the last two were really nice as well. So it started and ended on really good notes, I would say.
Yes, I would agree. The only caveat being that, yes, the first 4 days had lots of beautiful things to see, but we were too exhausted to really enjoy them that much. For us, it wasn't that much of a problem because we live here and we've been here to those places before, except for Mafra, we had never been to before. And again, we arrived at about 6 p.m. in Mafra, so we didn't have time to go inside the palace there and visit it. Even if we had time, I did not have the energy. So yeah, that would be something to keep in mind if you were going to do this route, you know, and this area was all new to you. you might want to figure in more rest days than you normally would, not for the purpose, well, for the purpose of rest, but also just for the purpose of sightseeing and taking in everything that there is to see. Because Sintra, for example, you definitely can't do properly in an afternoon after a full day of walking.
No, not at all. And so if you actually started from Estoril, that would be your first day. You would arrive in Sintra on your first day, and then it was a bit weird to take a rest day on day two. But if you wanted to see things in Sintra, you absolutely would have to do that. So moving on to practicalities, and we've touched on some of these things before. Firstly, looking at waymarking. And we started from Lisbon, as we mentioned, but then once we got to Estoril, we did start to see arrows, and it was signed the rest of the way. And the interesting thing that we had forgotten, because we'd seen some of these signs before when we'd done these day hikes, that it is signed, it's double signed for Fatima and for Santiago. So you have blue arrows and yellow arrows basically the whole way. We, as we've mentioned, had GPS tracks as well, and so we were using a combination of both. And when you have tracks, you tend to perhaps not pay so much attention as to whether or not it's really well signed, because you always have the tracks. And if you sort of come to a fork in the road and you don't see an arrow, okay, you just look at the tracks and then you kind of forget about it. Osvaldo, who you were following on this blog, he was trying to use, or was exclusively using, the arrows. And so he was making comments day by day as to whether that day was particularly well signed or not. Mm-hmm. So he was, I think, paying more attention to it than we were. I would say overall that it's pretty well signed, although the actual signing is quite old now and some of the arrows have faded quite a bit. And so sometimes you wouldn't see it unless you were really, really looking for it. To have that as a backup, I think you would need. Mm-hmm. But the arrows are pretty good for the most part.
For the most part, yeah, I would agree that you would need to have tracks as a backup, but you could mostly follow the arrows, probably.
On the second last day for us, which was our ninth day, leaving Alcobaça and actually past a place called Ajubahota, we merged with another Camino, which is the Camino de Nazaré. And this is a Camino de Fatima, one of the official Caminos de Fatima, and Nazaré is a coastal town famous for its big waves, but it also means Nazareth in Portuguese, and so that's perhaps why it's been prioritized as a Camino. But it's only a 50-kilometer Camino from Nazaré to Fatima. But as soon as we hit it, and we hadn't really thought about it or weren't really aware of it or where Nazaré was, because it's on the coast and we were inland, but all of a sudden we just hit a new type of signage that we hadn't seen before, and it was signed both ways, one way to Fatima and one way to Nazaré. And basically the signage that we'd been following were arrows that were, you know, painted on things that were already there for the most part. You know, if there's a telegraph pole or something like that, or if you're in a more forested area, you know, on rocks, there would just be arrows painted. And every now and then there were some markers that were custom built there. But once we hit this Camino de Nazaré, suddenly there were signposts which were custom built for the Camino. The arrows were very, very clear. And there was also information. It would tell you what the next town was, and it would have icons saying, you know, whether it had accommodation or a shop or a cafe or what have you. So suddenly we felt like we were really on a Camino now after, you know, following 8.5 days, following these kind of faded arrows. Suddenly we got a lot better arrows. And that was a little bit interesting in terms of waymarking, because there were a couple of times, because what we did was we then downloaded the tracks, which you can get from CaminosDeFatima.org. And so we overlaid the tracks for this kind of newly created or newly marked or remarked Camino from Nazaré with our old Camino de Mar tracks. And there were occasions where the tracks differed. Mm-hmm. And that can create a little bit of confusion, because then the signage differs. And there was also some other confusion on the last day, whereby what we believe is that the new signage for the Camino de Nazaré differed from the new tracks for the Camino de Nazaré.
Yeah, it seemed to, because there was one point where we were following the arrows, because the arrows seemed quite good and reliable and, you know, very frequent. We kept coming across them over and over. And so, yeah, we saw some arrows and followed them, and then suddenly looked down at the tracks and realized, oh, we're not on the tracks anymore. Neither on the old Camino de Mar tracks, nor on the new Nazaré tracks that we just downloaded. And yeah, we did get a little bit lost that one time, but made it back to the tracks in the end. So yeah, there was some ambiguity and confusion about that.
Although the walks that we did, there were sort of two sections of it in particular on that last day, those were spectacular walks and among the best parts of the whole Camino. But then, yeah, we realized that at some point something went wrong, either with what we were doing or that they haven't updated the tracks properly, or the tracks and the arrows don't match up, or something like that. But it's just something to be aware of, is that there are two sets of arrows for this last around 30 kilometers perhaps into Fatima, and so that can just create a little bit of confusion, but with common sense it's more or less okay. And the other thing I want to talk about with practicalities is just stages, which you mentioned a little bit earlier, and accommodation. And yes, we had seen tracks that people had left on Wikiloc, and they had done it from Estoril to Fatima in 7 days. And we ended up taking 10 days, including the essentially extra day starting from Lisbon. So let's say 9 days from Estoril to Fatima. And that was because basically all of those days were about 30 kilometers each. And I don't know, you know, it's not as though this is a very well traveled Camino and that these stages are gospel. There's no grance for this Camino. It was just something that we had seen, but I kind of looked and we looked at the stages and thought, wow, we don't really want to do 30 kilometers day after day after day. And it was a little bit difficult to break those up. And as we mentioned, the first 4 days we followed this sort of typical stage length, because there just didn't really seem to be accommodation options for us. And then after that, we were able to break it up a little bit. But as you mentioned, on a couple of occasions, we went off the Camino because that's just where we could find accommodation. Although it was interesting looking at those, let's not say official stages, but the stages that we had seen, it seemed as though the reason for making the stages what they were was more the distance rather than the end point, in terms of both what the end point was and in terms of accommodation. And so, for example, you mentioned that Obidos doesn't tend to be an end of stage destination, and Alcobaça is the same. And these are great places that I think you should definitely stop at and stay the night at, because it gives you more of an opportunity to enjoy them. But we had seen, yeah, these other stages which didn't include staying in those places. And then, for example, instead of staying in Alcobaça, you can go a little bit further to Aljubarrota. But Alcobaça is a much better place to stay. It's a larger town. There's more services. There's restaurants. There's shops. And in Aljubarrota, there's one place to stay, but I don't know if there's any more than that. And so this, again, perhaps comes from the idea of the Camino de Fatima, where you're not so much looking at where you can stay. There aren't albergues on these Caminos. And we met, for example, one man who said his father-in-law walked it and he just slept on the side of the road.
Yeah, it was an old man who came and sat under the tree with us while we were taking a rest and started chatting with us, and yeah, asked if we were going to Fatima, and we said that we were. And so he told the story about his father-in-law, who I'm sure has long since passed because he himself was not a young man. But yeah, he said that when his father-in-law was 80 years old, he had just left without telling anyone and started walking to Fatima and had just slept, yeah, on the side of the road, didn't have any accommodation.
And so even this Camino de Nazaré, which has just been recently done or redone, it's only a 2-day Camino, and the village that they say that you should stop in is halfway, more or less exactly halfway, but there's no listed accommodation in the village.
Yeah.
So maybe you just sleep on the church porch or whatever. But, you know, when we're planning our stages, we like to have somewhere to stay. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to do this for the second half of the Camino and walk slightly shorter stages. And so that's something that people can do. But it is a bit tricky on those first few days to break it up without doing these long stages.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, there are no albergues. So we were staying in private rooms every night. So that is something to keep in mind, too, in terms of budget, that it's going to be more expensive than doing a Camino Frances or somewhere where you have albergues as options, because there wasn't a single albergue.
All right, so to end today, let's just talk about a couple of discussion points, and we've already gone on for quite a while, so we'll try to keep it short. And the first one is, can the Camino du Mar be an alternative option for walking the Camino de Santiago from Lisbon, rather than just walking the standard Portuguese way, which from Lisbon takes you through places like Vila Franca de Xira, Azambuja, Santarém, and then Tomar? So on the Camino de Mar, you can walk to Fatima and then to Tomar, so you could choose that as an option of getting to Tomar and then continuing up to Coimbra and Porto on the regular route. So I think a couple of things to say about this. Firstly, is that it would be longer. mm-hmm. if you do that by about four stages, I would say. But that's something that could be a positive. You know, I've seen people say before, I want to do the Portuguese way from Lisbon, but can we start further south because I want to make it longer? So if you do want a Camino that's about, let's say, maybe 100 kilometers longer than the standard CP from Lisbon, then this could be a choice for you for sure. The second thing, though, is to be aware that there is a lot of road walking, a lot of asphalt walking. So if that's something that you do not want to do on your Camino, then maybe that's not the best choice. But I do think, you know, taking that into account, that the attractions on the way, and also considering that it is longer, so there's more of an opportunity for there to be attractions, that the attractions are better mm-hmm. on the Camino do Mar from Lisbon to Tomar than on the Portuguese way.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, Santarém is a nice town, so you would be missing that. But to balance that out, you're gaining quite a number of interesting towns that are on the Camino do Mar that, you know, we've mentioned already. Cascais, Sintra, Mafra, Alcobaça, and then also the museum in Odrinhas that you mentioned before. That's a really interesting site too, if you're interested in history at all. Not just a museum, there are actually ruins, there's an archaeological site next to the museum. So if you balance all of that out with Santarém, which is really the only place worthy of note that you would be missing, then I think the Camino do Mar does clearly have more historical and cultural sites to offer than the traditional central Portuguese from Lisbon.
Yeah, and the other point to note here is that we didn't see a single other pilgrim while we were walking. So some people say even the standard route from Lisbon is a bit quiet, you know, compared with something like the Frances, which it obviously is. But this is even quieter still. So if you're looking for some solitude in terms of not seeing many other pilgrims, then the Camino do Mar can be for you. But yeah, it's quite likely that you won't see anybody.
Yeah, until you get to Fatima, depending on when you're going there. So that's another conversation. We did encounter many, many pilgrims, but none of them actually on the Camino, only in Fatima.
And so the final thing to talk about, and this will lead into what we talk about in the next episode, is that we did mention last time that there are some official Caminhos de Fatima, but that Portuguese people in general just walk from their hometown along roads to Fatima, and that's kind of the way that they do it. And so it sort of led us to this interesting stage where we can see that now there are some Camino de Santiago style Caminos being developed for Fatima. For example, this Camino de Nazaré, which is only a couple of days. There's another new Camino which has just been launched this year, which is the Carmelite Camino coming down from Coimbra, and that's themed in that way. So some of these Caminos are starting to be developed, but we're kind of asking ourselves, having done one of them that's being described as being in development. And so it's possible that they will then turn their attention to this. And by they, we mean the people who seem to be in control of the Caminhos de Fatima at the moment, which is a cultural center that has some kind of office here in Lisbon that you visited to get our credentials.
I did, yes. It's the Centro Nacional de Cultura in Portuguese, so the National Center of Culture. I don't know a lot about what they do, it has to be said, but according to their own website, they do seem to be kind of in control of the Caminos that go to Fatima.
So we were thinking as we were walking along this Camino, it would be nice if there were some changes made, for example, the things we've talked about, taking it a little bit more off-road and doing new signage, for example. But then, you know, we just are a little bit unsure of whether or not these Caminos really have a great purpose, because this is not how Portuguese people walk to Fatima.
No, and we knew that, but I don't think we really fully grasped the extent of it until we experienced it ourselves, having met literally no one, not a single pilgrim in the 10 days that we were on the Camino, and then we suddenly arrived in Fatima and there were thousands and thousands and thousands of pilgrims who had all come from different places, and you could see where they come from because they're wearing fluorescent vests, which they need to because they've been walking alongside busy roads the whole time. And so they would always have the name of their town where they had come from. So they walk in groups, very localized groups that I imagine would be led by a priest or other people from their church. And yeah, it's not something that people do on an individual basis very often. I don't think it's very much a group project. And yeah, they, like we've said before, they start from wherever they happen to live. And yeah, generally just walk along the road from there until they get to Fatima. So this path doesn't do that. It's a pretty roundabout route to get from Lisbon to Fatima, because there is always already the, you know, the Portuguese Central, you can just follow that. And that is also marked with blue arrows as going to Fatima. And then you veer off from that. So this is a more roundabout way of getting there. And, you know, you pass through a lot of interesting places that we've been talking about. But yes, I gather that that's not really the main, that's not the kind of way that Portuguese people approach it. They're not thinking about what interesting things can I see along the way.
Right. And someone told us that point blank, and we'd mentioned it in our previous episode anyway. But then when we were walking, someone said, we don't do this for hiking. We don't do this for outdoors. We do it for faith.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, when we got to Fatima, a couple of hours after we arrived, we saw a group coming and they were from Sintra. And it was written because they had the t-shirts and the fluorescent vests, which said Sintra on it. And we hadn't seen them at any point along the way. And so we can only assume that they went a completely different way from the way that we went. And so, yeah, we sort of have these ideas for maybe how you could improve the Caminho do Mar, but we're just not sure if that's going to become a priority to continue to develop these new Caminos in a mindset of the Camino de Santiago for a Camino de Fatima, which is a different thing entirely. And so it's just an interesting thing to follow, and just an interesting thing to see how it develops in the next few years. Will it change? Will people decide that they want to do more of a nature-based rural Camino that is off highways and off roads? Or are they going to continue to walk the way that they know and the way that perhaps their parents did and the way that's tradition here in Portugal? So it seems like there's kind of a, will there be a balance there between the two different types of pilgrimages you can do to Fatima? And what will that mean for the future of the Caminho do Mar?
Yeah, or the other option, I think, is that this, they do continue to promote this kind of Camino and these particular routes to Fatima, but, you know, marketing them to foreigners and not to Portuguese, because I'm not sure that Portuguese people are really going to be interested in it.
Right. But then the other thing you have is that Fatima is very much a Portuguese thing.
Yeah.
And so even though we did see groups of non-Portuguese people in Fatima, but it's less likely that foreigners are going to want to walk to Fatima rather than Santiago.
That's true. Yeah. But a lot of people do combine the two, or I don't know how many, but I, on the Camino de Santiago forum, I definitely see people saying that they want to visit Fatima on the way to Santiago. So I know that that's something that some pilgrims do. So there are possibilities for combining the two. And this Camino do Mar that we just walked is certainly one of them. But yeah, it's an interesting question to think, who is the target audience? Because there's a lot of work that is being done, and, you know, and a lot of potential work that could still be done to improve these paths. But who are you doing it for? Is there really an interest there? And yeah, what's going to happen in the future?
All right. So we'll leave you all with that question to ponder. And we'll be back in the next episode to talk all about Fatima itself, the destination for this Camino. And until then, bon Camino.
And buen camino.
Thanks for listening. For more great content about the Camino de Santiago, visit our website at spiritofthecamino.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Spirit of the Camino. Buen Camino. Buen Camino.